Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin working on a help desk, a networking engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And we are at episode 31. Now, 31 is a prime number. It's the atomic mass of gallium. M31 is the Andromeda galaxy, and also in binary, 31 is 11111. So perhaps this should be episode 11111. Anyway,
nice.
Well, that's the show title then.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. So
I do all my invoices in binary.
So we're all here this week. I know we've got a few things to go through, stories from the trenches. So what's everyone been up to?
Well, I'll be on the phone to GoDaddy for most of the afternoon.
Sounds like a laugh.
Not. One of our customers is their UCC certificate, so for their exchanges about to expire. This is one of the migrations I've been working on. They're basically running Exchange 2007. They've got about five Exchange servers dotting about. And for some reason, someone has put 15 different names in the certificate. So, you know, normally an SSL certificate, you have one name, like something like mail.abnabnpodcast.co.uk, or you have a wild card, which is like star.abnabnpodcast.co.uk. Well, some of the Exchange protocols don't like having a wildcard certificate, and they used to be a lot more expensive than borrowing a SAN certificate. So a SAN certificate and a UCC certificate means that you have to have your main certificate name, and then you have like other names in there as well for things like AutoDiscover and .legacy or things like OWA addresses in there. And with the old days of Exchange 2007 and 2010, you'd sometimes even put the old internal domain names in there. So for some reason, it's got a load of names in there, and things like portal dot this company name and secure dot. And why they do this, I have no idea. So, but when we move them over to Exchange 2013, you don't have to have many, you only have to have a couple in there. So we basically only renewed the certificate for a year. And because I didn't want to change much with their current infrastructure, I was going to basically renew the certificate for a year. And then when we migrate the certificate to the new servers, we know what domain names are being used in that certificate. And can you remember a couple of episodes ago, I was telling you about that you can't, they won't issue after 1st November internal names anymore on SSL certificates, so like a .local.
No, .local, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this certificate had .locals in it. So I basically, I basically wanted to create a new certificate. I don't want to basically re-extend the existing certificate. I basically created a CSR request, and then there's a PowerShell command you run. You basically put all the names in it. So I thought, I'll put it in there and see what happens. And when you put it on the website, it says, oh, this certificate's got these domain names in it. So I did that, and it says, oh, you can remove the .local one. Says, all right, then, because I knew that after the 1st of November it wouldn't work. But then it had some net BIOS names, so it had the net BIOS names of the extra Exchange servers. And once I did that, it said you didn't need to delete those, it said I could have them as a certificate. So I go along, basically put it on, and it goes, oh, you have to now verify your own domain name. Funny enough, you have to, I don't know if you've ever done that before with an SSL certificate, you have to basically there, either with GoDaddy, you have to basically put a little file on your website for the web address, but because obviously I had 15 addresses, I wasn't going to put this little text file on 15 websites, because obviously the domain names they've actually put in the certificate weren't actually, they haven't actually got websites for. So next thing,
is that to prove that you have the domain?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the other thing you can do is create text records. So I basically put a request in with a DNS provider to do this, but they took a couple of days to do this. But what they were doing is they sent an email to the person who's on the Whois, and they basically clicked on the link, and it basically authenticated and said, yes, you own the domain. But oh yeah, hooray, got my certificate. So I went and put it on the server and went, hang on a minute, just check one thing. This runs out on the 1st of November. 1st of November 2015. Why is that? Why is this? So I phone up GoDaddy and say, why hasn't this got to 2016? And they said, hang on, I know what. You've got internal domain names in there and it will only issue a certificate to the 2015. Like, well, you could have told me that when you were doing it if I couldn't have those internal domain names. So you couldn't, and to basically extend it to 2016, they couldn't re-key it. They basically had to delete that certificate, revoke it, and then recreate another, and give me another account, give me another UCC certificate, which is annoying, because if they have to revoke it, it would mean breaking my production environment. So after being on the phone for an hour or something with the thing, they finally gave in and gave me a free one, as if I could promise that within that day, I would generate the CSRR, basically download it, and then put it on the website, get it all working, and then phoning them up and saying to revoke that old certificate and then delete it. So, yeah, that was a bit annoying speaking to on GoDaddy today. But it's ridiculous. It's like £270 they spent on a certificate for like having 15 domain names in it. So, okay. So that's my fun with GoDaddy today. So what's everyone else been up to?
Yeah, I've got a couple of things on the list here. I'll go through them on the list and I'll come back to them. One of them was security certificates on not just Firefox but Internet Explorer. You know, when you visit a website and it says this security certificate invalid.
Yep.
Now this is actually on the network that we've been talking about on the last few episodes,
mm-hmm.
with that Draytech router. So there's something maybe one of you can clarify in that. I've also been setting up this. I had trouble setting up this printer on a network printer on this network. I've had a few things with Windows 10 bugs, and also a WordPress problem, which I've yet to. Well, I haven't looked into it too much at the minute, but I've yet to resolve anyway. So there are my few things. But going back to the one with the security certificates. In fact, I sent you a quick message during the week, and then I figured it out before before you got it. I'd let that network set up with the Draytech router and the tags and the VLANs and all of that. So I got that going, and they called me up in the week, and they said, everything seems okay, but the main computer, which is the original old TIL computer, every time they go to a website, it says this website has an invalid certificate. They were using Firefox. And I thought, oh, right, okay. So when I got there, I kind of figured it out after a couple of minutes.
Was it the timeout on it?
Yeah. The date on that tower was 2014. Don't know why it was 2014, but it was basically a year out, almost exactly a year out. Now, I very much doubt anyone's changed anything, but this only happened after we put the Draytech router in. So I'm wondering, is there any kind of correlation between the old router, which was an old crappy one? I think that tower had the wrong date then. But since the Draytech's gone in, we've got these warnings coming back. Is there anything that the Draytech would do differently to just a basic crappy router that
It's possible it could be blocking UDP.
Yeah, right.
Because NTP uses UDP.
Yeah.
It's quite unlikely, but might be doing that. I'd sort out NTP on everything, and see how you go. I mean, there's some forms of security get fussy if you're 5 minutes out, so I'm not surprised that
it was a year out. I had seen that. I've seen that before on workstations, you know, when the these have been good ones. You know, people have gone away on holiday, for example, and they turn all the computers off at the wall, And then the BIOS battery goes flat because I've been away for 2 weeks. And when they switch it back on again, it goes back to 2002. And then everything goes crazy then. You know what it's like if the time's wrong? Everything goes crazy. You know, virus definitions are just going mad. Problems like this. But that's what I was wondering, if the router had anything to do with it. Doesn't that use port 123 or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, UDP 123.
123.
Yeah. I can't see it. I never had a VIG or block it before.
I mean, but...
there's
a slight possibility someone's changed the time.
Yeah.
Just in the last week since I've done it, but I just thought it's unlikely. I want to change the date back to normal. It worked fine. So. Mm.
Do you have everything syncing to? I don't know where it is in whatever version of Windows you're using, but you can tell everything to just sync to, I think it's time.windows.com or something.
Right. No. No, I don't.
Definitely a good idea.
Yeah.
Basically, in Windows, the built-in goes to time.windows.com using the built-in feature. But if it was on the main, it does different things. There's a podcast I've talked about this already on the one we talked about it. I'll put the link in the show notes for that. But I don't like the Windows times because it doesn't always, even I've had it where it's 10 minutes out and you just go say check with the thing and it says it's not right, it's not the right time kind of thing. It's the right time but it's 10 minutes before. So I also, it's like the pool.org or uk1.pool.org or whatever. So yeah. It is not as annoying.
I think with NTP, at least on Linux, I think on Windows as well, you can turn it on, but then it will correct itself if it's wrong, but it'll do it very slowly. It's like, yeah. It's something like it'll take, if it's, say, an hour out, it'll take something like 2 weeks to correct itself. So that could be a factor. On Linux, something I found out recently, because we switched to using Windows Domain Controller as our time source.
Yeah.
And we were using something else. I don't think it was a Linux box, but it was it's like a hardware device, I think. And I found out that the NTP date command, which I'd used up until then, is actually deprecated, so you're not supposed to use it anymore. I guess it's they're not developing it anymore. So you use the NTPD command. And it took me a while to work that out. Bit of googling, you can use NTP dates. It's something you use to just set the time to the time source, and then NTPD is what kept it in check. Whereas now you're supposed to use NTPD for everything, and there's a switch minus G, which if it's more than about, I don't know, 5 minutes out or something, you have to use the minus G switch to get it to go from wherever it is to whatever the actual time is. I think Windows is similar. I think there's a command you can run, net time, I think it is, or net W32 time or something like that, to just get the clock in sync and then start the NTP service.
It's amazing how critical the time is, isn't it, really?
yeah, especially with security, because like I was saying, I think it's Kerberos will complain if it's 5 minutes out,
yeah.
And it will refuse to do anything.
Yeah, if the PCs are out of 5 minutes in sync with the time, with the domain controller, that can cause loads of issues in Windows. But I'll put a link in the show notes because we did do a show.
It was one of the early shows, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So why does it bring up an error? Is it because it sees it as some kind of hacking or anything like that, or why does it say there's a problem? You know,
when it does a certificate check, it goes. So obviously, with a certificate, it's got a valid date on it from when it was created to when it was when it expired. So the worst thing is, first thing it does is check if the certificate's valid, if it's in that date range. And obviously, if the certificate was generated in 2015 and the time on the computer was 2014, it goes, hang on a minute, this certificate isn't valid yet because it's not 2015.
Yeah.
And that's what generates an error message.
Yeah.
So is this similar to what you were doing with GoDaddy?
Yeah,
was because it the same certificates.
Yeah. Because the certificate was basically going to expire, and that's right. you have to go and regenerate it and get a new certificate.
The different websites have potentially different lengths of certificates as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
When you generate a CSR, as I understand it, I haven't had much to do with this because my employer doesn't really. Well, no, I don't want to say they don't care about security, but internally there is no security, so it's never really had to deal with certificates. But I did look into it because I'm thinking of moving maybe at some point, and I thought I'd better brush up on it.
Yeah.
You generate a certificate signing request, which goes off to a certificate authority, which in our case would be GoDaddy. And when you generate that request, you can then, I think, specify the length of time the certificate is valid for.
No, when you're doing a CSR, all you tell it is what key size you want it and what domain name you want it, you basically want in that file. And then when you send it to GoDaddy and you pay your money, they then tell you how long it's going to be, basically.
Okay.
But we do another show on that because I'd like to do a bit more about that. But I want to do a bit more research before I make a fool of myself.
Yeah, I think I will as well.
The site with the V then, is that all working good now then, Jeff?
Yeah, the one of the people working there said. On one particular day that they thought it was slow, but when I was there they said I was being fine for the past couple of days, so I don't know exactly what they were doing to justify that it was slow. You know, they could have been the computer they were using at the time or something, I don't know, but I've been back a few times and I've connected and it's worked, and they only actually have I suppose it's efficient, but they've got a 4 meg internet connection.
Okay.
They're not exactly getting hammered. Mind you, they do stream, so. But I mean, even so, it should still be okay. But otherwise, all the security features are working fine. You know, the passwords work. You know, the different subnets are blocked from each other and all that kind of thing. So otherwise, it's working really good.
All right. Because I had a message from Al, the other Al, this is in the show, and he was telling me that, I'll just read it out, he just said, I caught the latest show this morning, and wanted to ensure I send you a message about those Draytech Vigors, and he said, the VLANs on those are port-based and not 802.1.q standard VLANs. They have their own port-based thingy, I believe, and are standard tag VLANs and trunks, I mean. Okay, and he said, I just wanted to mention it. Loving the Linux aspect of the show, wishing Jay would talk a bit more, and he's very passive at times. He's a good balance with the three different approaches and different skill sets and area of main work focus. But he's actually looked at the new Vigors, and they actually are 802.1Q VLANs. And it looks like he remembered that Fuminal back, he got caught out with them being port-based. Yeah, I've been caught out with them, but now they are definitely 802.1Q standard, which means that you can then, they're basically VLAGging correctly, and then you can interoperate with other switches.
That right, yeah.
Okay, I think my router, it's not a Draytech Vigor, but it's a TP-Link. I think that's got port-based VLANs as well. It's not bad for a 70-quid router.
No, I mean those Draytechs you got were quite expensive, but I think it's worth it though. Yeah, they do the job. They're very, it's good stuff. Does the job definitely. So all that seems to be going okay. So that was one of the things I've done this week. The other one was, this is a quickie, I was setting up a network printer at this dentist's office. And, there's another thing. I've been on the phone to Exact as well today. Mm-hmm. And I was setting up this printer. I'd like to hear some opinions or some views on which is the best way of doing this. I was setting up the printer. It was a Xerox printer. And I was setting it up with a static IP address. And I was having trouble seeing it on the network. And then I realized when you do a static IP address, I had to set a static primary DNS on it as well. Because when I hadn't done that, I couldn't find the damn thing. Because when you set it to auto, it should set them by itself. But when you do it manually, you've got to type in certainly on this printer anyway, you had to type in the primary DNS as well. So I just put that as the router DNS. Mm-hmm. And then it's seen it. But I mean, that wasted half an hour before I figured out what I'd done wrong there.
But how are you printing to it? By IP address or yeah. By like a... Okay.
Yeah. Well, that leads on to what is... Because I know the other way of doing it is having what do you call it? Like a name. The words left me.
So you're basically DNS printing. Name.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So in a situation...
What
was
that, sorry?
Yeah.
What was the word?
Like a DNS name. So you can basically so you could call it Xerox. So instead of remembering the IP address, you could type in Xerox and it would get
So does it matter on what setup there is? But what is the better way of doing it, do you think? Or does it really depend on the setup, whether you give it a static IP or a name?
You need an internal DNS server to be able to resolve the name or have it in the host file on all the systems.
Right.
So for your size of company, I would just give it a static IP address and then do it by that. I wouldn't even worry about it. Because the problem is, as Jerry said, you'd need some sort of internal DNS server to do it.
There's no server on this system either, you know. It's purely... I just wanted to give it a static IP so it didn't change on the DHCP at any point for whatever reason. Even though I think they have... How long's your normal... expiry time, is it 24 hours usually on a normal router?
Depends.
Generally, I'm fine.
Depends the router, really.
Least time, that's what it's called. Least time,
yeah.
Because primarily that printer's going to be left on all the time. So it's not really going to get a chance to get a new IP, is it? But
I think generally a lot of DHCP servers, the same MAC address gets the same IP, generally.
Yeah.
Because it's all done by MAC address, isn't it? So.
Yeah. So, that was a little issue I had with a printer. After I got that resolved, I went round every machine. I had to tell Exact, which is the dental software, what printer to print to, because that didn't use Windows printer settings. It used its own. So, but all that worked out fine in the end. I've had a few more Windows 10 bugs this week. One of them where it crashed, Microsoft Edge, the new browser. And this guy's, all his links wouldn't work because Edge crashed. And I've had another one where, after upgrading to Windows 10, Explorer.exe, kept stopping and restarting itself. So, you'd have all your icons on the screen. Next minute, it disappeared, and then it'd all come back again. It was like stuck in a cycle. The customer, actually, at that point, he'd reverted back to Windows 8, because he went from 8.1 to 10. Then he went back to 8, thinking it had fixed the problem. And then it was still low when he went back to 8. So... I can't remember what I used exactly. I just used a command to re-register the DIL files, I think I did, or something like that, to repair that file. But I've had quite a few different like little buggy things with Windows 10. I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with Windows 10. It's just more bugs and little problems. Everyone I've seen has had a different problem. And they've all been little problems, you know, that you've resolved quite easily.
Is this a result of upgrading rather than doing a clean install?
Yeah, it is, yeah. I haven't done it, but like the customers thought, if I'm going to go to Windows 10, they go through the procedure, something messes up. Some of them have then reverted back to where they came from, and the error's still there. So, you know, a clean install would be a lot better, obviously. Or maybe if the system was cleaned up first, you know, and got all the crap out, maybe an upgrade would work a lot better then.
I think that's the problem, yeah.
You know, any problems you have, you just carry over. But, you know, I know people have put 10 on to fix it. You know, they've had problems with 7 or 8, or they think, oh, if you install Windows 10, all those problems will go away. But when they do an upgrade, they just carry on, don't they?
So, yeah.
Yeah, so that's that. Now, the other problem I've had, I haven't really looked too much into it yet, is I don't really look after this website, but it's a WordPress website. We can put this in the show notes, but if you both go into our show notes that we've got up, it just says what the error message is on the very bottom line of our show notes.
Syntax error.
Yeah, whenever you go to the website, or you try and go to, you know, / WP admin, is it? You know, to log in.
Yeah.
These are the errors that we're getting.
Okay.
And because we can't log in, I can't fix it at the minute.
You'll need to. Well, have you got? Is it a shared hosting account or?
They've got the hosting. I can access the hosting. Yeah. It goes through. Their hosting is through Namecheap. And the package it's from is. I can't remember the name of it now. Damn. it's installed from the cPanel, basically.
Okay. I mean, you have either shell access or FTP access, and you'll be able to go to that file, and it's literally what it says. There's a left, a less than, where there's like one too many or not enough greater thans.
Okay.
So you can probably literally find out where the missing one is or where the unexpected one is and just get rid of it.
Okay. So we can do that via the... because if we can get into the cPanel, we can go into the file manager in cPanel and find it that way. Yeah.
Or there'd be FTP or SFTP access.
Okay, yeah.
Or if you've got shell access, even better, because you just go in and do it in Vi or whatever.
I'm not sure if they do, but we've definitely got the other access. I haven't got the usernames or passwords off the top of my head, but I can find them out next week easy.
Yeah. I mean, I'm no web developer, but that looks pretty simple one to solve.
Yeah, well, I mean, how this error occurred is they... I also was thinking about getting in touch with the host, you know, the web hosting people as well, because what he'd done, the owner, his hosting had ran out and he hadn't paid. So the website had gone off. So I suggested to him, I said, look, you'll have to pay for your hosting again, you know, for the next year. So they went on and did that and paid him. I said it might take 24 hours for it to come back on again, and then so I left it to them. When it came back on, they've actually got two websites in the same place. The one hosting package does both of them. The other website works great, and this one didn't. So somewhere when this hosting got suspended because of lack of payment, and through it getting switched back on again, this error has occurred. So I thought also I'll try your way. I'll try going in and have a look myself. But otherwise, another other option was to get in touch with them. They have like an online chat, live chat facility, you know, and say, you know, since this happened, we've now got this error, you know. And I'm not sure if they can go back to a previous version. I'm not sure if they can have some kind of backup, you know.
Well, the file's been changed somehow. I mean, I don't know. Because with WordPress, it's just basically a load of code.
Yeah.
Which throws up a website, basically a CMS, content management system, and then you can do your own thing on top of that, and it's got plugins and things. But this particular file, WP Includes, I think that might be like a third party type thing.
Ah, right, is that one of those add-ons, yeah.
Yeah, but that looks pretty simple. I mean, it could be horribly complicated, but it's basically saying that this file is wrong and it can't make sense of it because it's got a less than where it's not expecting.
Yeah, I can see that now, unexpected less than in that particular link. So, I mean, I told them on the phone, said, worst case scenario is we've got to rebuild the site from scratch.
Yeah.
But it's not a complicated site, to be honest, but it's just, you know, somebody's got to do it, and I don't think he'd be too happy, through no fault of his own, he's got to pay somebody to remake a website again. You know, even though it might just be a couple of hours to bung all the information back in.
Yeah.
So
have a look at that file first. Make a backup of it if you can, and then just have a bit of a hack, because you won't make it any worse.
No. No, I could learn something from it. So, okay, I shall do that next week.
Well, maybe if you get the username and password, and then we'll have a bit of a hangout next week, maybe with Jerry and me, and then we can dial and have a look, kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's no problem doing that. Yeah. Excellent. So, well, that's me. I'm all out. I'm out of information and things. Everything else I've done this week has not been related to computers. So there we go.
Cool. I've got a bit of stuff to talk about. A client has asked me to look at using AWS, Amazon Web Services, for WordPress, his WordPress sites. Segueing nicely from your thing there Andy.
Somebody, everyone thinks this is all planned out in advance.
I should have said, talking of WordPress, shouldn't I? But
we've gone from Al's SSL to my security certificates to WordPress to your WordPress. So there we go.
This is most unlike a normal episode, isn't it? Anyway. AWS, Amazon Web Services. I suppose I could go over that a bit. Amazon have got a shed load of computers, and they basically rent them out to the public. At the moment, this client, he may not actually be a client for much longer after today, actually, but that's a different story. It was an interesting exercise, this AWS stuff. He's got hundreds of WordPress websites on about three or four different servers, and he wanted to put them on Amazon Web Services. I don't know at this point whether that's a good idea or not, but yeah, we'll see. But one of the things they do is provide virtual machines, and this is called EC2, stands for Elastic Compute Cloud, but it's basically virtual machines. We talked about them in previous shows, but it's quite it's the way you can do it is quite, there's different ways. You can go to the AWS website and just say, I want a virtual machine, I want it to have, there's a range of operating systems you can put on it. You can put Windows on it if you like, but you can also talk to it via an API. So something like Ansible, which is a config management software that I've mentioned in the past on the show, you can tell Ansible to say, spin up a VM, 2 cores, 2 gigabytes, give it this disk image. Off you go, or you can do that for any number of VMs, just from an Ansible playbook, which I've mentioned. So you basically store it in a text file and say, tell Ansible to spin up all these machines using the API. And I guess there's other ways you can do that as well. It's basically a way of telling AWS to do this stuff without having to go to the website and click through menus and things. So the power of that is, say you want to scale a website, i.e. you want to add more web servers, you can maybe put something in your code that says, if the load on this machine is getting too high, give me another 5 web servers. And the code talks to Amazon and, hey presto, you know, 2 minutes later, there are your 5 web servers. And then you can use config management like Ansible to configure those web servers. So that's an interesting way of doing things, maybe. The other thing that Amazon do, or one of the other things that Amazon do, is something called RDS, which is, it will basically present a database to your to the world, or to your Amazon EC2 virtual machines, which is useful because it means you don't have to run MySQL on your virtual machines. So it's sort of, and it's quite, you know, if you have heavy usage, you might want to consider using this rather than trying to tune your virtual machine, because it's all done in the background by Amazon. So yeah, that's another thing to think about for databases. And it doesn't just do MySQL, I think it does Postgres, Oracle, which is, you know, the things that you might be using for your database, if you're using it for a web app or whatever. And then the last thing was, the last thing I've looked at, S3, which stands for Simple Storage Service. Today, actually, I saw a sort of de-jargoning thing for AWS, which tells you about all the services and what they are in plain English.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll put that in the show notes as well, because it's handy. Now, S3 is basically object storage, cloud object storage. So you can stick data in there, and you can refer to it from your EC2 VMs or whatever. You can put stuff up there, and you can get it back out. You could use that for assets on a website, which in that jargon, that just means basically pictures, documents, and things like that. Stick them in S3, and they're visible from your EC2 servers, your WordPress sites, or whatever. That's basically a sort of a way of using Amazon Web Services, replacing a sort of traditional server running the actual web server itself with a database and storage. Instead of that, you're using 3 different services from Amazon to accomplish that. Now, I have heard that's quite expensive to do, and it's kind of worked out on a, you know, you pay by however many requests you get from S3, or you pay for the amount of hours that your VMs are running.
Mm-hmm.
And with the database service, you pay for the number of requests there as well. So, you know, it's a tiny amount, but it obviously adds up. The more traffic you get, the more expensive it is. I may never get to roll this out for this client, but it was useful to look into it, and it might be useful to see how much it all costs. I've heard from developer friends that it works out quite expensive, so there may be a better way of doing things. But it's a kind of an eye opener for me, because I would have just said, "Oh, just spin up some VMs and we'll do it all on there." But you know, there's ways of there's other ways of doing things.
Why did he want to go to Amazon Web Services? Just because he heard it's a cool buzzword at the moment?
Or? Yeah, probably. I think maybe his mate down the pub said, "Oh, you want to be on AWS so, or something."
But people say people say it's cheap though. But is it only cheap if you're rolling it out? Like if you've got a website and you know it's going to be hitting lots of people with traffic and you can easily expand it, kind of thing.
It depends what you want to do with it, I think. I mean, like I was saying, this RDS service will deal with traffic spikes a lot better because a traditional LAMP server, Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP, has a single... MySQL runs as a single process. It doesn't kind of scale very well. It's often a bottleneck with applications because it's just a single process, runs on one CPU, and you once it gets sort of choked up, everything has to sort of queue up, and that's where your if you've got a lot of traffic and which is doing a lot of database queries, that can be a problem. So, you know, RDS in that sense is quite good. I mean, I don't know if you can use it on its own RDS. I.e. have a server which talks to RDS. You probably can. More research needed, I guess. I'm going to a talk next week about AWS, and you know, someone that uses AWS a lot is going to tell people how how to use it, basically. So maybe something to report back on the next show. So yeah, so that's something different, something interesting anyway. Next, I've been asked to look at Ansible, which I just mentioned, and which I talked about before on previous shows. He wants me to look at, or actually I suggested putting it into his infrastructure to configure his... He's got quite a few Linux machines now which need... sorting out. So mm-hmm. as I said before, the power of Ansible is or any configuration management system is you don't have your collection of shell scripts doing the configuration on all your machines. You've got a sort of standard framework for doing it, and what he's got is a Nagios server, which is monitoring software, and he's monitoring lots of his clients' sites, but the way that's done is a separate Nagios instance on each site that gets around firewalls and things. So basically a Nagios server on the site does the checks, reports back to the central server, and everything's controlled by SSH. So you're allowed SSH into the client sites but not out, and then you're allowed to talk on the Nagios port, which is 5668, which is the Nagios database software. That's what you're allowed to talk back to the central server. So all these different machines on all the client sites need to be configured in a certain way, and I wrote a script many moons ago which kind of does it, but it does it in one shot. No possibility for keeping things updated. Well, there is, but it'd be a big rewrite. So my plan is to put Ansible in there, get all these machines configured the way they should be, and see how that goes. So nothing actually done yet, but again, something to report back on.
Cool.
And yeah, the last thing was copying from one IMAP mailbox to another. So IMAP is a mail protocol. I used to know what it stood for, but I don't know off the top of my head. if you don't count Windows, there's two big mail protocols, IMAP and POP. IMAP is Internet Mail Application Protocol or something, and POP is Post Office Protocol. The main difference is that IMAP is like a folder structure, basically, and that sits on the server in a folder structure, and your mail client basically replicates that folder structure to so you can read your mails and put them in folders and things. If you want to migrate that, this is where my knowledge falls down a bit. You have an IMAP server, and the data sits in a certain format on the server. And if you want to get that data, that mail, from one server to another, you have to copy it somehow. Now, the format that it's stored in could be different on those two servers behind the scenes, but the two things that the servers have in common is they both speak IMAP. So to get that mail from server A to server B, you can literally go in a mail client and just copy the stuff by hand, but there's a little utility called IMAP copy which will basically do that for you. It has a simple config file where you set the source server and destination server, and it has then has a username password field which you fill in, and that config file, and then you kick it off and it will read out of one mailbox and write to another. The one thing that I came across with this one was the IMAP server was IMAP S, which is secure IMAP, which is going back to the certificate thing that we mentioned earlier. And to get around that, I had to basically tunnel the secure IMAP to another port, and because IMAP copy doesn't support SSL, so I used a utility called S-Tunnel to tunnel that SSL IMAP SSL port to a clear port on the server. It's done on localhost, so there's no one else could get around the SSL. Mm-hmm. So on the server itself. And then ran that, and that did the trick.
Cool. So were you basically just you're importing IMAP from one server to another way? So you're basically setting the IMAP on a new server then, basically?
Yeah, well, he had IMAP mail, or his client had IMAP mail with the provider, so which is one and one. And so I had an IMAP server address, a port, and the username password.
Yeah.
And that's all IMAP copy needs to work with, unless it's SSL, in which case you have to tunnel it. So
yeah. It's like on the Windows box, you'd probably use Outlook, and you'd basically import, download it and put it into a PST file and then reconnect the connection back up.
Yeah.
And then re-import it. But that's a really good tool. I've never heard of that. I'll have to keep that in my...
Yeah.
Something for a back pocket, that is.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I've used it quite a few times now. It's people require it quite a bit, I think. Yeah. You know, just moving... Because a lot of people web developers often supply email, which is a bit of a can of worms, really. If you can, you want to offload that to someone else to deal with spam and things like that. But, they often need mail moving from one place to another. And it's a big chunk of data. So, I had this one client that he had a web server he was running his website on, but most of the data was email because he was using IMAP. So, yeah. And it's, in some ways... A big security risk and everything as well, and you could end up spamming people and things like that. So, yeah, good to know about that. I didn't know much about email admin about 2 years ago, but I know a heck of a lot more now.
So yeah, I've had fun this week as well with this. Going back to, I'm doing quite a lot of Exchange stuff at the moment. Is that this site I was talking about earlier? They've got 5 Exchange servers, and we're going to consolidate it down to 2 Exchange servers in the end. But at the moment we're going to consolidate down to 3. And in the last episode, I was telling what you had to basically remove to get rid of before you can install it. So I basically shut down the servers this week, about a week ago, and nothing broke. So I basically powered them up and went to uninstall Exchange. All you did, you go into the control panel and uninstall Exchange, add me programs. And it basically got, it did everything. Basically, yeah, I'm running uninstall Exchange, blah, 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 removed the, this role, that role. And it basically just sat on 100%, but it never ever got past 100%. And the last thing I wanted to do was kill this, this setup in case it was trying, it was doing something in the backdrop, in the background. And I basically, I googled it, and it, and the first one was a knowledge base from articles saying that that if it get it gets stuck at 100%, it's because there's a problem, because there's a PowerShell.exe present in the background which never executes its action. So I basically just go, you basically go into the task manager and kill it. And so I killed that PowerShell.exe. It the setup came back and said, "Yay, Exchange has been uninstalled." So, uninstalled it on both. It happened twice to me. There must be a bug in that service pack or something. So, I managed to uninstall Exchange twice. Those two sites. Now, we're now getting there, the bits to look at upgrading to Exchange 2013. They're basically running Exchange 2007 at the moment. But I'll probably go more and more as I go do the project. I'll come more about that on that. And the other thing I've been doing this week is, Exchange 2016 previews available. So, so we're running 2013 at the moment. It's the latest, it's the one that's kind of live at the moment. And they basically release one every 3 years normally. So 2007, then 2010, 2013, and then there's 2016. So basically you can basically go to the website and you can download it. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And it was really easy to install. I basically didn't do an upgrade, I basically did a fresh install. And then I'm basically calling it Service Pack 2 for Exchange 2013. Because there's nothing much, that if you go into the GUI, or into the website for the EAC, there's nothing much changed. It's all the same website kind of thing. So it's not, not much changed on it. So that's what I kind of like saying it's Service Pack 2. Because basically Service Pack 1 is released at the moment. For 2013, but it's basically built on all the things that are in Office 365. So you've been using Office 365 as their test ground for it, basically. There's a lot of OWA improvements for it. OWA, it's again, it's completely different. Better hybrid improvements if you're running it with Office 365. And now they're not splitting the roles up again. So before, like in the past, I've talked about how you can have Exchange roles on separate things. So you have a CAS role or a CAS role and a mailbox role on two separate boxes. Now you can't split them out. They're all on the same box. Again, so Microsoft have gone back on what they said when they like Exchange 2007, where they want, oh, you can distribute all your roles. Also, there's going to be more integration with SharePoint 2016. Whereas that when you upload a file into Exchange, when you go to send it to attachment, you know, like if you send an attachment to like everyone gets it, and then you can everyone edits it the little cells and send it back to you, and then you got to merge it up. But with SharePoint, it does that for you, so it lets you know who's got it open, or you get multiple people editing it at the same time. There's an improvement with SharePoint 2016 and attachment integration. And there's something else I'll put in the show note, we'll talk about next week, is that how do you stop people doing a reply to all? Because apparently I saw the article from one of the Exchange Geary people I follow on Twitter, that someone sent an email out accidentally to like the whole company, like 60,000 users on it, and then you get everyone starting to reply to all saying take me off this list kind of thing. So obviously you get loads of reply emails, obviously, and it obviously kills your Exchange server. So we'll talk about that next time. I'll put a link in our show notes to look at that. But it's basically just how, I don't know if you've ever seen that before. Have you ever been on one of those emailing lists where people are saying, please remove me from this list kind of thing, and everyone then clicks reply to all again, and then everyone gets that email kind of thing. So I'll put that in the list in the show notes, or in our notes, so we can talk about it next time. send all email. Right. So, the last thing I want to talk about, I've been on the Veeam course this week on the day, which is, I probably heard me talk about Veeam before. It's quite interesting. And they're talking about the 3-2-1 rule of backup, because that caused an interesting thing to remember. And it's basically saying that the 3-2-1 rule is, one, that you should have 3 copies of your data. So you should have 3 copies of your data at any one time. 2 of those data should be on different media, and 1 of those backup should be off-site. So what they say in your report, you should have 3 copies of your data. So 1, you should have 1 in your production data. 2 is your, is obviously your primary backup. And then the third one is your off-site copy. And it says 2 different media. So normally you'd have your backup copy will be off your production area. So you don't want to be backing up to your production area. So if you've got a SAN with your production VMs on it, you don't want to be backing up to that production, because that's obviously a point of failure. Because if your SAN goes down, then you've got it. So normally you'll be backing up to a NAS or a box with loads of disks on. And obviously keep one copy off-site. So that's like if you've got a tape drive, or if you're replicating it off to a remote site. So remember that 3-2-1 rule with backups, really. Have at least 3 copies of your data, store the copies on 2 different media, and keep 1 backup copy off-site. So, yeah, that's cool. So, is there anything else anyone wants to talk about tonight? Or
I think I'm done for this week. I've more to update on next week, no doubt.
Did you want to have a quick talk about grep and regular expression?
Regular expressions, yeah. I think you asked me, was it 2 podcasts ago or something, 2 episodes ago, something like that. So I think probably the easiest way to sort of broach the subject is anyone that's used a command line has probably used a wildcard, star. For say you want to do, you've got a directory called admin, and then you've got a directory called admin, and then you've got another directory called admin, amongst a load of other directories. So if you do, in Linux anyway, if you do ls admin star, it will list those 3 directories, admin, if that makes sense. So that's a way of saying, show me everything that's called admin with anything after it. So it will only list something that has the word admin at the start, and it can be anything after it. So you could have admin podcast, and you know, it would still be listed. Okay, so that's a form of regular expression that people might be familiar with. Now, excuse me while I get my cheat sheet up, because I've used it. I don't use them a lot, but they are useful, so it's worth going over them. Excuse me. So, okay. Now, the time that I use it most in Linux, because I'm not much of a developer, is a utility called grep. Now, at its simplest, grep will do something. It will match a string. So it will match, say, I don't know, Fred, in a list of things. This is me looking at my example here. So if you say grep Fred and then the file name, it will go through the file and it will list lines with the word Fred in them. So that's the simplest way of using it. Now, with regular expressions, you have things like, you can specify, only show me if it's got Fred at the beginning of a line. So the way that you do that is called character, which is shift 6. So if you do grep shift 6 Fred, it will pull out all lines of that have Fred at the start. And then another, that's called an anchor tag. And then now, if you want to match something at the end of a line, it's dollar. So if you say you have my name is Fred as one line, if you did grep Fred Dollar and then the file name, it will pull out that line. So you can see how this might be useful, maybe. So in Bash or at lots of config files, you have comments which are, we've got hash. So any line that starts with a hash isn't read, it's just a comment to tell people that are reading the file what's going on. So if you want to generate a file without any comments, you could do grep minus v, which minus v is show me all the lines that don't have this. You say grep minus v caret hash, or pound as they call it in America, and then the file name, and that will show you the file without any comments. So that's a real life example of where you might use regular expressions. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say about what's the difference between egrep and grep. Is there any difference between what an egrep?
I think it depends what box you're on, what version of Unix you're on.
Okay.
I think egrep is, I think, because it's not as simple as I've just described. The different sort of languages have different ways of using regular expressions. It's like Perl has its own version, you know, Bash has a different version, and they've all got slightly different ways of working. I think the caret and the dollar is pretty much universal, but I think, yeah, not knowing enough about it, I think that's about as much as you can rely on.
Egrep is apparently, egrep is the same as grep space minus capital E.
Okay, yeah. But then that only on Linux, you know. Yeah. If you're on any other Unix, you might not get that.
Yeah.
So, you can do things like ranges. You can say, well, just to read it off this example, egrep, we use egrep, caret symbol, and then capital A dash capital K. That says find all the letters. So that's saying caret, which is the start of a line.
Yeah.
Find me any line that starts with any letter between capital A and capital K, and then print those out. Or you could do a number, you know, say 0 to 9. You can have A to Z, 0 to 9, for instance, and that will show you anything that starts with a number or a letter. So it's just it's a way of saying this. Yeah, what is it? A way of saying it's a way of filtering, basically. Filtering.
Yeah. Yeah, because I was just, yeah, I know you use it quite a lot on Linux. I was listening to another podcast now talking about it, and I never really got my head around what it is, but I don't think I kind of understand it. So, like, if you had a text file, and it had 1,000 people's names in it, and you wanted to find out in that thing, how many, just list all the ones with the name of Solomon Smith in it, you could basically use that command to search that text file. Yeah. For all those things, if you see what, all those.
Yeah, well, in Linux, everything is a file anyway, so that's where you see the power comes from.
Yeah,
everything is a file. So if you can grep anything, you know, you can grep the proc file system, which is basically a representation of what the kernel's seeing. So you can grep for things that are sort of dynamic things within the system.
All right.
So that's where it becomes quite powerful.
So you could grep what servers or what processes IDs are running, basically.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I use that quite a lot. You do the ps command, PSAUX is the switches I use.
Yeah.
We'll show you all the processes in the process table, and then you can grep for the process that you're looking for or the user you're looking for. And you can then even do things like you can find out the PIDs of all the processes that you want and kill all those processes. You know, so, you know, that's where it becomes fairly powerful.
Yeah, because the way we were doing it as well, as one of our load balancers, one of our customers using regular expressions, it was looking, if someone typed in the name of the website, so like whatever it's www.company.com, and when it goes through the load balancer, so they want to rewrite that that URL to something else. So using regular expressions, they'd say change the .com to .local kind of thing. So when it goes through the load balancer, it gets an internal name kind of thing.
Yeah, you find that a lot with caching systems as well. Yeah, because they're matching strings of text, and they want to rewrite headers and things like that on stuff that's going in and out. So you know, you say if it's this website, do this. If it's this, that website, do that sort of thing. So, yeah, that's where you use regular expressions, processing text, basically.
Cool. Well, now I think I've got a more understanding than I did at the start of the show. Yeah. So thanks for that. I might have
no
to go.
Worries.
And there's like a thing, you put a link in the show notes about how to, like, it's got like a text file and it basically just shows you what you can do. I have to have a go at that. The kind of it basically just shows you what you can do to using the regular expressions to
Basically, I wanted to find a simple way of explaining it and also try and understand it a bit more myself. So if it's helped me, hopefully it'll help someone else.
Good. Okay, I think we're just about done for today. So, yeah, thanks for listening, guys. I mean, we're talking about Odd Camp. We're going to be there this year, Odd Camp 2015 in Liverpool. We've got Margaret My Room booked and our tickets booked.
I just did mine today, so yeah.
I've got my room booked as well.
Yeah.
You come in your bike, did you say, Andy?
No, I'll have no wheels left.
You find it up on bricks.
Good. Okay, well, guys, thanks for listening as always. You can email us at mail@abnabinpodcast.co.uk. You can follow us or whatever on our Google Plus, Twitter, and Facebook pages if you go to www.abnabinpodcast.co.uk. All the links to the social medias are there. So see you all next time.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.